You're listening to KSCO Santa Cruz, Salinas, Monterey, and San Jose, and 104 FM. This is From the Bookshelf. I'm Gary Shapiro. Thanks for joining me. What do Grace Kelly, Madonna, Marilyn Monroe, Elizabeth Taylor, Beyoncé, Carol Burnett, Diana Ross, and Cher have in common? They are all subjects of best-selling biographies by my guest, J. Randy Taraborelli. Randy Taraborelli's new book is about the rivalry of two famous sisters and their mother. The book is Jackie, Janet, and Lee, The Secret Lives of Janet Auchincloss and Her Daughters, Jacqueline Kennedy Onassis and Lee Radswell. J. Randy Taraborelli, welcome back to From the Bookshelf.
Thank you. It's great having me back. That's kind of a great introduction when you think about the fact that I'm the person that they all have in common.
And, of course, I left out quite a few. You've written a lot of books.
Yeah, this is actually my 20th book, and it turned out to be my 15th New York Times bestseller, so I feel really blessed to, you know, have a nice built-in audience that will buy what I write, and I think that's just really a cool thing to have as a writer.
Absolutely. Congratulations.
Thank you.
I always wonder about you. Why, you know, I know you've written books about Michael Jackson and some others, but mostly you write about powerful and interesting women. What is it about women that sparks your imagination?
Well, that's a really good question, you know, and you're absolutely right in the sense that even when I'm writing about the men, it seems that I gravitate toward their wives. Like, you know, when I did After Camelot, which was about the Kennedys as a whole, the most interesting characters in that book to me were the wives of the Kennedy men. Gosh, you know what? I don't know how to respond to that except to say that I love women and I love the complexity of women. And I think men are a little bit more sort of, I guess, cut and dry in terms of their emotional response to things, whereas women are more generally more romantic and maybe have deeper feelings than men. I'm speaking in generalities here, you know, but this has just been my experience as a biographer, is that the women that I've written about give you a little bit more depth to work with. Like when I did Frank Sinatra, for instance, his reactions to situations were pretty predictable, Sinatra-like. You know, he was a tough guy, full of bluster, you know, could be arrogant, had a soft heart, but there weren't a lot of surprises in the way that he responded to people. You know, usually it was a good fist to the nose, right? But the women that I've written about, you know, I love strong, powerful women, and I think Jackie, Janet, and Lee are three of the strongest women I've ever written about, and certainly Janet Auchincloss, the mother. I've never been so lucky as to have a character like that to write about. She is one in a million, and she's a person that the public doesn't know anything about or didn't prior to my book. And so that makes her even more interesting to me.
Well, that kind of anticipates my next question, which is, you know, when you wrote your big old book about Beyoncé, which I think was the last one that you published, which was great, I loved it.
Thank you. But
I think, you know, there hadn't been any books about Beyoncé. But there have been many books about Jackie Kennedy, including two other books by you. So what did you see in this book that no one had written about before?
Well, you know, with the other books that I've written about the Kennedys and the other Kennedy books written by others, the lens was always pointed toward Jackie and her relationship with the Kennedys. And we always viewed Jackie as a Kennedy, as if she just was born into that family. And, of course, that wasn't the case at all. And I was guilty of that as well with my previous two Kennedy books. I mean, I didn't spend any time trying to figure out who Jackie was before she met Senator Kennedy. And so I was just as guilty as everybody else in thinking that that wasn't of interest to people. But what I found is that she was a fully formed formidable woman before she met Jack Kennedy in the mid-1950s, and that's because of the way she was raised by her mom and with her sister Lee and her half-brother Jamie and her half-sister Janet Jr. and her stepfather Hugh Auchincloss. All of these people are people that the public was never exposed to while Jackie was in the White House or even after that. And by design, because they were private people, they were not interested in the limelight. They were not interested in being the focus of attention. So you didn't see them posing, in Architectural Digest with their homes, and you didn't see them on the covers of magazines. And they were private people. And wow, who better to write about as a biographer than a private person, you know? I mean, it practically never happens. There's no privacy anywhere anymore, you know. So that's what this book really is about. This is about looking at Jackie through the eyes of her own family, not through the eyes of the Kennedys. And you'll find that with the exception of JFK, who Jackie was married to, obviously, there are no Kennedys in this book. You know, I purposely did not want this to be viewed as another Kennedy biography by me. So you're not going to find Kennedys coming in and out of the stories. This is really a family story about the Auchinclosses and the Bouviers, which was Jackie's and Lee's, you know, original families.
Well, Randy Tabarelli, in this new book, Jackie, Janet, and Lee, you tell some stories that we've heard a million times, but you tell them from a different, just as you were just saying, from a completely different focus. For instance, the November 22nd, 1963, a day that we've lived through, some of us, and a day that we've read about in multitudes of books, but never from, you know, Jackie Kennedy's mother.
Well, you know, thank you for mentioning that, because that's what I wanted to do. You know, obviously you need to tell the story of the assassination, and obviously that needs to happen in a book about Jackie, but how do you tell that story without recreating every story that's ever been told about that, including by me, because I've written about it twice. And I thought that the only way to do it is to tell it through the eyes of the mother, to tell it through the eyes of Jackie's mom, and through the eyes of Lee and their experience of it, which has never been told before. And I think that what the reader gets is a completely different vantage point, and it's a completely new way of telling the JFK assassination that I think is really compelling.
I found it compelling. But so what I want to know is, how did you get these stories? Who did you talk to? I know Lee Radziwill is still living, but who did she participate in the book, and who did you talk to, and where did you look for all the information that you found?
Well, my primary source was Jamie Auchincloss, who is Janet's only son and Jackie and Lee's half-brother. He's also the only surviving brother-in-law of President Kennedy. And Jamie was there for all of it. I mean, he was the ring bearer at Jackie and JFK's wedding. So he goes way, way back. And as Janet's only son, of course, he was very protective of her, which is fine by me, because I need that person to advocate for my subjects. You know, I need a person who actually knows my subject, who can explain her motivation behind certain decisions, because I wasn't there at the time, and Jamie was. And I also depended a lot on Janet Auchincloss's oral histories, which are found in the Kennedy Library, the JFK Library. The JFK Library has been very helpful to me in all of my research and all of my books with Kennedy related for the last 20 years. And they allowed me access to Janet's oral histories. And so to actually be able to hear Janet explaining, for instance, her response to the assassination, I mean, everything in the book about Janet and the assassination of JFK is directly from Janet's own memory, as per her oral history at the Kennedy Library. And what kind of amazing foresight was it for them to get that on tape, you know, because they realize that this is important, and one day it's going to matter. And I'm luckily the guy that dug it up and made it matter, you know, because those oral histories have been sitting there since the 60s and nobody has touched them, you know. So I was really lucky to have that kind of access, you know, and there are other many other family members and all kinds of friends, and you know, not only that, but you know, I also drew, as I explained in a source note, from all of my research from my other Kennedy books, and you know, when you've been around the block with the Kennedys for 25 years, as I have, you meet a lot of people, you gain a lot of trust, and you're able to tell stories that other people have never told.
Well, one of the stories that I thought was pretty fascinating, since you mentioned Janet's son, Jamie, the half-brother of Jackie and Lee, is the kind of unusual circumstances of his birth and the two latter children in Janet's life.
Well, you know, she was, Janet Auchincloss was really a one of a kind. I mean, she was the kind of woman who would not accept no for an answer. And she married Hugh Auchincloss, even though he had told her that he was chronically impotent. She had previously had a very passionate relationship with Jackie and Lee's father, Jack Bouvier. So it was a big sacrifice for her to marry somebody with whom she knew she was not going to have that kind of passion. But she did it, and she did it in order that her daughters would have a lifestyle that she thought that they deserved. And it was at a great sacrifice to her. And at some point along the way, she decided that she wanted to have two more children, or she at least wanted to have one more child. She ended up having two. But because of Hugh's condition, it was just not going to happen. So she decided to avail herself of a new technology that was just being developed. And at the time, it was called test tube babies. Actually, it was artificial insemination. And she went to New York, and she met with top researchers in the field, in this brand new field, to try to
this
determine
was
how...
1947, right? I mean, I thought
yeah,
that I was just so impressed that such a thing existed in 1947.
Yeah, so was I. I was completely impressed, but leave it to Janet to figure this out. You know, that's the kind of woman she was. I mean, she was a really... She was a researcher. You know, as you read in the book, she's always got her hands in something. She's always studying. She's trying to figure out history. She's researching. And she researched this, and she realized that this was a possibility. It was remote, but it was a possibility. And she went to New York, and she talked to some doctors about, you know, how do I do this? Well, what they gave her, she felt, was very complicated. She thought it had a lot to do with syringes and test tubes, and she was like, oh, this is just as ridiculous. I think I have a better and faster solution. Now, we don't know what that it was exactly, because it's been so long that even her own son wasn't 100% sure how his mom did it, and most certainly it wasn't something that he and his mom were ever going to openly discuss. But somehow or another, Janet made it possible for her to become pregnant without having sex with her husband, and that pregnancy resulted in the birth of their first child together, Janet Jr. And then they went on to have another child, and that was Jamie. You know, so the point of the story really isn't so much what Janet did to have these children. The point for me is that she was a woman who would stop at nothing to make sure that she had the life that she wanted, and never accepted anything less. When Hugh Auchincloss, her second husband, told her that he was chronically impotent and that he had accepted that as a reality in his life, she was amazed that he would do such a thing. Not that he was chronically impotent, but that he would accept it. You know, she encouraged him to see doctors and go to psychiatrists and try to figure it out and don't accept this limitation in your life. And he just really had come to his own personal decision that this was okay with him. But that's not what Janet would have done. Janet would have found a way to solve the problem. And when having children became a problem, she found a way to solve it.
And you're listening to From the Bookshelf on KSCO. I'm Gary Shapiro, and my guest today is J. Randy Taraborelli. He's the author of Jackie, Janet, and Lee, The Secret Lies of Janet Auchincloss and Her Daughters Jacqueline Kennedy Onassis and Lee Radswell. One of the things that intrigued me, Randy Taraborelli, when I first got this book, the Jackie, Janet, and Lee, is this beautiful picture that's on the cover, because I always think when I think of Carolyn Kennedy or John Kennedy Jr., they look a lot like their father. But this picture on the cover, Carolyn Kennedy resembles Janet Auchincloss strongly.
Yeah. Yeah. Isn't that interesting? Well, you're absolutely right. I mean, a lot of people have... Wow, that cover is interesting because I have gotten such a response to that cover. People have studied that cover and really studied it and scrutinized that cover and have read a lot into that picture. And what people have gotten from that picture, first of all, is how striking Janet is, and that, yes, she definitely has a resemblance to her granddaughter, which would be Caroline Kennedy Schlossberg, that you could definitely see the family resemblance. What people have also gotten from that cover is how much Jackie at that age, which is about 16, looks like Jackie Kennedy, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, she, as her brother put it in the book, she just had an air of fate about her, you know, that there was just something about her that always stood out, that you just knew that she was going to be something. You know, that girl in that picture is so obviously destined for something that if you look at that, you're really not surprised that she ended up being First Lady. And also from that picture, what I've heard from people is how sort of ordinary, and I don't mean that in a pejorative sense, but just how ordinary Lee is. Like, she is just a young girl who is in that picture. It looked like she's struggling to keep up with the other two.
Mm-hmm.
And they're in lockstep, and she's sort of just one tiny half step behind them. And that so much says so much about the way Lee lived her life. You know, that she was always one step behind the other two. And in many ways, that's the reason Lee lived such an extremely interesting life, is because she really wasn't like her mom or her sister. She was completely unique in every way. She had her own ideas about men. She had her own ideas about career. She did her life her way. And I think that you get a lot of that sort of feeling from that cover photo.
Well, one of the things you get from this book is that Jackie, Janet, and Lee are very imperfect people, they don't always say the right thing. They're not particularly nice to each other. They struggle with a lot of that.
Sure, and I love that, because isn't that the way it is often? You know, you're also find in that book there are those moments, you know, when they're in tune, you know, that there are those moments when Jackie and Lee are close. People ask me on my book tour all the time, well, what were they like? And my response is always, well, it depends on the day you found them, you know. And I think that that's the humanity of the story, and that's what resonates, I think, with so many people. At my book signings, it's practically all mothers and daughters, and I think it's because people get it, you know, that these relationships are complicated. And it's not just these three women. These three women are not that unique. If you take away their wealth and their entitlement and their popularity, what you really have is a mother and two daughters trying to figure each other out. And that's pretty much the case with most families. You know, we're all just trying to figure each other out. And sometimes we're not that nice to each other, and hopefully we're able to reconcile it. I wished that this book had a happier ending. You know, I'm not going to give away the ending to people who haven't read it yet, but it's not as happy as I would have liked. And I really had been campaigning in my head for a better ending to this book, but unfortunately I'm tethered by history, and I pretty much have to write what happened, you know. But what I really wanted to happen was what I think all families should do, which is I wanted these women to sit down and have a real conversation. And that was something that they had a lot of trouble with. Janet says in the book, secrets, that's what we do best. And she was very conscious of the fact that what they all needed to do was sit down and have a full and total airing of all of their disagreements with one another and their long-held and long-harbored animosities toward each other. And since they weren't able to do that, it often led to great dysfunction in their lives.
Well, one of the revelations I found in your book was the role that Aristotle and Onassis played in their lives.
Yeah. Well, it was interesting for me because I've written about Onassis twice in the past, and I've actually even had him portrayed in two miniseries that I produced, including the last one I produced, which was last year with Katie Holmes and Matthew Perry in the miniseries based on my book After Camelot. And we cast a great guy named Alex Siddig as Aristotle Onassis. And I kind of thought I knew Aristotle Onassis pretty well based on what I've previously done, but in this book I think you get a different picture of Onassis, and certainly I didn't know until this book that he and Lee were romantically involved before he and Jackie, and that Lee ended up having to give him up. She gave up Onassis because her mom, Janet, insisted that she do so rather than bring scandal to Jackie's White House. Because Lee was married at the time that she was going with Onassis, and Onassis was considered a criminal by many people in this country. And so Janet insisted that Lee break off with him, and she did it for her sister. And then years later, in 1968, she did it again, you know, when she realized that Jackie needed Onassis more than she did, that Jackie felt that she was a target, and so were her children, after JFK and Bobby were assassinated. And that Jackie needed Onassis' security, and she needed his protection. And Lee felt that if anything were to happen to her sister and her niece and nephew, as a result of Lee's wanting Onassis and depriving Jackie of having him in her life, that Lee would not be able to live with herself. So she gave him up twice. And I think that I didn't know that. And so for me to be able to tell that story of Lee's selflessness, I think is something that I think is something people should know about her if you really want to understand who she is. And I was happy to be able to tell that story.
To what degree do you think post-traumatic stress disorder affected Jackie Kennedy's life after November 22nd, 1963?
Well, as I wrote in the book, I think every decision she made was a consequence of post-traumatic stress. And even her mom felt very strongly that she was not in her right mind when she decided to marry Onassis. Janet did everything she could think of to even persuade Onassis to leave her daughters alone, because she realized that this would come between her daughters, that this relationship would be a problem, that it would come between Jackie and Lee. And Janet didn't want that to happen, and so she tried to convince Onassis, and Onassis basically said, look, your daughters are old enough to make their own decisions, and they should be allowed to live their own lives. To which Janet said, well, that's the most ridiculous thing I've ever heard of. In Janet's mind, a mother's job was to make those decisions, not the daughter's job. But anyway, to get to your point, Jackie, you know, suffered greatly from post-traumatic stress, and many of the decisions that she made, I think she didn't make in her right mind. And she spent years battling a PTSD, and eventually I think she overcame it. But it was not easy for her at all.
Well, this book, I think, you know, your books are always popular and people love them, but I think this is the best reviewed book of your career. There have been some fabulous reviews.
Well, thank you for saying that. I have to tell you, you know, the New York Times review of this book was pretty astonishing for me. And I mean, I think that after 20 books, I've never been reviewed by the New York Times, you know. And so most writers just assume that if you're going to get reviewed by the New York Times, you know, you're lucky to be in it and you just hope for the best.
Even if they pan you, it's better than them ignoring you.
Exactly. And
but they didn't pan you. They were really, really effusive in their praise.
Yeah, they were completely effusive, and I think that they really got it, which really I found so gratifying. You know, I mean, you don't write books for praise in the New York Times, because if that's your goal, you're in big trouble. I've been writing books since 1984, and this is the first time they've even noticed one. So if that had been my goal, I would have spent the last 30 years, you know, in a fruitless ambition. But when you finally do get that full-page treatment in the New York Times and they love it, it kind of makes the 30 years worthwhile.
Well, it's a really fine book, and it's called Jackie, Janet, and Lee, The Secret Lives of Janet Auchincloss and Her Daughters, Jacqueline Kennedy Onassis and Lee Radswell. And the author, New York Times bestselling author, J. Randy Tarabarelli, my guest today. Thank you so much for spending some time talking to us, Randy.
Thank you. I really appreciate the interview. Take care now.
That was J. Randy Tarabarelli, author of Jackie, Janet, and Lee, The Secret Lives of Janet Auchincloss and Her Daughters, Jacqueline Kennedy Onassis and Lee Radswell. Joining us now is artist Claire Rosen. In addition to being an internationally exhibited photographer, Claire Rosen is also the author of Imaginarium, The Process Behind the Pictures, a book about the process of creating art. Claire Rosen, welcome to From the Bookshelf.
Thank you so much for having me.
You know, I saw some of the images from your latest exhibition, I think it's in Brooklyn, and they're so wonderful, and I hope our listeners will look up your page, Claire Rosen, what is it, ClaireRosen.com, I guess.
ClaireRosen-.com.
Yeah, and look at some of these pictures, ClaireRosen-.com, because they're...
Claire-Rosen.com.
Claire-Rosen.com. Now you got it. Just Google Claire Rosen, and it's like the first thing.
It should come up.
Yeah. And I hope they'll look while we're talking, because the pictures are amazing, and they're hard to describe, but describe them, if you wouldn't mind.
Sure. Well, I have a couple of different projects. All of them revolve around a sort of whimsical interpretation of fairy tales and children's stories, and have a lot of anthropomorphic animals in them. So my favorite current project right now is a series called The Fantastical Feast, which are animals eating around banquet tables, and they're live animals and really fun to do. I set up tables, and then they come and eat, and they're these large format panoramic pictures that look like The Last Supper. And then I have a portrait series of birds that are in front of antique reproduction wallpaper, sort of create this optical illusion, and some still life series that references 17th century Dutch masters' paintings.
Well, these animals that are gathered around the table eating, you have turtles, and there's flamingos. What have you got exactly eating, having last suppers?
I mean, I think the smallest are honeybees, and the largest are either bison or elephants eating peanut butter sandwiches and peanuts. But there's a big range in between, from squawks to cobras to hyenas, cheetahs, the Galapagos tortoises were a favorite, parakeets, deer, ducks, little turtles. It's been quite a menagerie.
So now I don't know what the right word is. You haven't faked these images. You went and got a bunch of bison and had them come to the table.
Well, they're real and they're not real. I work within the resources that I have, and so I go to the places, I set up the tables, and then the animals come and eat. And how many I have sort of ranges on what I can get access to, and obviously what's safe for the animals, because some of them can't be together. And the best, you know, sort of expressions and faces of them eating are then put together in Photoshop. So I would say that it all happens, just maybe not at the same time.
Oh, I see. So maybe there might be one elephant, but it looks like there's several.
Right. I think there were five elephants for that one.
And so you just went down to the neighborhood rental elephant place. How did you get five elephants?
Yeah, exactly. Well, all of this has been really very synchronistic, because I'm, self-funding it myself. So whatever resources I can get my hands on, I happen to be friends with the clown. So that is how the elephants happened.
I mean, he's like a clown in the circus, you're saying?
Mm-hmm. So he introduced me to an elephant trainer. And I think the interesting thing for me with this project has been the sort of animal advocacy around it, and sort of thinking about what our relationship is to animals and how we interact with them and what our responsibilities are towards them. And I think the circus is a really interesting example of that. I think they're making really important strides in protecting the animals and sort of distinguishing that they're not for entertainment, that they need to be treated well. So this really was an interesting time to kind of have that conversation. And I'm organizing now. I lost the word I wanted to use for it, but the print sales will, a small portion of them will go to the animal that is specifically in the picture. So like the elephant one will go to the organization or sanctuary that is protecting the retired circus elephants, which I think is a really important part of the project, that each one will refer back to help protect or advocate or raise awareness for the animals that are in the picture.
Well, I imagine that some of the pictures that you took were really dangerous. I mean, like, of course, the cobras, but like the bees. Did you get stung during the bee?
I didn't, fortunately, though. I think that might have been the scariest one. But, you know, I try and have conversations about safety, because obviously I don't want to get hurt. I don't want any animals to get hurt. So that's all really discussed in advance with the owners of the animals. So, for example, with the bees, I was told, like, don't wear any perfume and don't wear any bright colors. And if you want, we have a suit for you. But I just, you know, stayed really still and didn't make any sudden movements. But it actually really sparked my interest in beekeeping, and I've recently become a beekeeper, which is really fascinating. They're, everything about bees, I think, is interesting. So,
so bees, a lot of work. Bees will figure in your work now even more than they have before?
I hope so. And they're really, really fascinating to observe.
And your, the other birds that are in front of wallpaper, these are living birds or taxidermy birds?
Uh-huh. I do have a taxidermy project of antique taxidermy. Those are all shot on sort of black background. It's called the Millbrook Collection. But no, the birds in front of wallpaper are all live. And all the back, they're photographed with the background. There's no Photoshop on those ones.
Well, Claire Rosen, isn't there an easier way to do the things that you do? Why do you choose the most difficult possible
way? It wouldn't be as fun. No, I really enjoy working with the animals. I really just love being around them. The photography is sort of secondary to the experiences that I get to have as a photographer, if that makes sense. Which is the real reason why I want to do this work, is to be able to travel, to be able to meet the people that I get to meet, and to work with the animals I get to work with. And that sort of collaborative, unpredictable element where you get everything set up as carefully as you can, and then you sort of have to completely surrender control and see what happens, and what you get you could have never really anticipated, and you would never be able to make it again. So I really enjoy that aspect of it, even if it can be nerve-wracking sometimes when they're not cooperative. But it's all part of it.
And as a photographer, do you have, like, when you make your prints, I mean, you use film, or do you use digital? And do you print a limited number? How does that work?
I'm a digital photographer now, which is definitely very helpful to be able to see what you're capturing as it happens, especially with the animals. And I make large format archival pigment prints that are pretty big in scale, big sort of murals, and I think that it's really a different experience to see them in printed form than on a computer screen.
And you have some kind of fancy printer, or you use the facilities somewhere? Or how does that work?
I have a great printer that I work with that really is fantastic at understanding sort of the color and what I'm going for. So he prints most of my stuff.
And do you say, okay, I'm only going to strike so many of these, and then that's
Sorry, the first part of your question. Everything's done in a limited edition. So you're not printing an unlimited number. So they would come in a few different sizes, and usually the bigger the size, the fewer number that you do of them.
I'm Gary Shapiro. This is From the Bookshelf on KSCO. We're talking tonight with award-winning artist, photographer, educator, and author Claire Rosen. She's the author of a book called Imaginarium, The Process Behind the Pictures. A really fascinating book. And it's not just about how you make pictures, but you intend this as a book for people to kind of help them discover how to create stuff and what it feels like to create.
I hope that it will help other people do that. I'm really, you know, get asked a lot about these images and how I make them and where they come from. And just in thinking about sort of traditional education, a lot of my process and a lot of things that I think were important to getting this work done didn't really have anything to do with sort of the traditional education of photography, like, you know, what your technical settings were, how you used your camera or things like that. It was much more about how you set your life up to be conducive to having ideas and being sort of self-reflective and trying to think of what you actually wanted to be doing with your time and using photography as a vehicle to accomplish that. And it became a really interesting process that I think not just about photography, but sort of like what you want to spend your time doing, what do you want to spend your life doing, and what do you want to contribute and share with other people.
When did you decide to be a photographer? Were you a visual artist in general? Had you done printmaking or painting or any of that?
Well, I had such a very hard time in high school, and my art classes were really the only places where I felt like I had any sort of voice, but I was pretty bad at drawing and painting, so it was a bit, I never thought like, oh, you could make a career out of this because you're terrible, even if you enjoy doing it. And then when I finally took my first photography class, which was at Bard College at Simon's Rock, it was this sort of immediate love and like, oh, I can get this stuff out of my head and communicate visually in an effective way that doesn't involve me trying to render something from my imagination. So even from my first photo classes, I was setting things up and making these little worlds. Even though they're sort of less sophisticated than what I'm doing now, it sort of was pretty immediate from the beginning.
But of course you were creating things from your imagination, even though you were using props to do it, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I would like take my sisters out in the backyard and put them in sheets like they were Greek goddesses.
Did they appreciate that?
No. I don't think so. Luckily, I had enough of them that I could rotate. I wasn't irritating one regularly because, you know, there are four of us all together. So I could usually persuade somebody to play along. Yeah.
And in your book, you talked about being influenced by children's stories, fairy tales, Oz books, things of that nature.
Oh, yeah. I think our childhood, I think most of the artists I meet when you start delving into, you know, sort of what their foundational experiences were and the really early influences aesthetically, it's pretty consistently that's this roadmap for what they're doing. And it's kind of like hindsight so clear, you're like, oh, of course this is the work that I'm making because these are all the things that I was looking at and the things that I was drawn to and got excited about when I was little. So for me, it was no different. We did, you know, trips to the Metropolitan Museum of Art really frequently and the Museum of Natural History and the circus and the zoo and all of those things, I think, really strongly impacted the things that I am drawn to.
Those dioramas at the Museum of Natural History in New York kind of resemble the work that you're doing.
Yeah, I think it's not, well, I wasn't maybe conscious of it at the beginning. When I sort of made the connection, it was like, oh my God, of course this is what you're doing. It makes complete sense now.
So do you have a bunch of ideas that are rattling around in your head and you can't wait to photograph them?
I don't know if I want to tell you because I feel like they may
people will steal
go away if I tell. there's a really great quote that I can't remember. I feel like maybe Elizabeth Gilbert reference, where she's like, you know, if you don't hold on to your idea and do it, it will flutter off and find some other artist to create it, because ideas need to be born. Although she said it much more eloquently than that.
So, but can you tell us what you're currently working on?
Well, I'm still working on the feasts. I continue to do those because I'd like to do a large format coffee table book, and that there's some key animals that I would really like to get for that. And then the projects are kind of like weaving into each other. Like my still life project, I would like to incorporate more live animals into, but maybe not as many as the feasts are. And I think the next thing I'm moving into are sort of dinner parties for two, where I'll have two animals together on like a date, maybe. So I'm thinking about that.
Well, you know, there's that expression, you know, more fun than a barrel of monkeys. And I think, I was thinking, a barrel of monkeys probably wouldn't be that fun. You know, they bite and they smell bad.
I've had pretty good luck with monkeys thus far.
You do have like a huge amount of them. Now tell me, in that one, is there really that many monkeys, or how many monkeys did you have?
Oh my God, there were so many monkeys. That was in Bali at the Sacred Monkey Temple in Ubud, and we got to go in before they opened. Very helpful park ranger. We had a conversation with in advance about how we could make this happen. So they, you know, it was completely empty in the morning because they're sleeping. So we set up the tables, and the rangers call them down at their normal feeding time. And it was like this quiet, then growing stampede noise. And they rustled out of the trees, and then suddenly there were, you know, hundreds of them. And I think they normally only get lettuce, so they were pretty excited by the spread that we had out for them. And it was amazing to watch them, like, sort of figure it out, like, navigate everything and figure it out and, like, throw the coconuts up in the air to crack them so that they could eat them. And it was really, they're not that different from us. Definitely interesting.
They probably knew. Oh, it's Claire Rosen. She's doing that famous. they're going to serve us food. I heard it from the elephants. Yeah. That. So you don't just do this in your backyard. You travel all over the place to do it.
Yeah, which is the best part. So I try and couple it with jobs that I have or teaching experiences. So somebody will hire me to go to a place, and then I will research, you know, what the options are in that place and try and get my shoots done on those, or sometimes family vacation, you know, whatever I can take advantage of to make this project happen.
The exhibition that we were just talking about is closed now, it's over, but what's do you have another one coming?
Working on a possible group show this summer in Boston, but I really want to finish, I'm really working on finishing the animal piece project, because I want to do an exhibit that's just that, that has like a sort of banquet table eating component to it. So I'm working on that sort of like installation, and then we'll have a sort of performance art theatrical aspect of it. So moving out of photography to more like installation and performance and culinary possibly.
Oh, well, sounds good. Sounds fantastic, in fact. And this book is called Imaginarium, the process behind the pictures. You can get it at Amazon or someplace like that where they sell books, and I highly recommend it. And the author, the artist, Claire Rosen, my guest today on From the Bookshelf, thanks so much for spending some time talking to us.
Well, thank you very much.
That's it for this week's From the Bookshelf. I hope you enjoyed the program and will come back and see us again next week. In the meantime, you can check out our podcast page at fromthebookshelf.com. You can subscribe to our podcast wherever you subscribe to podcasts, and you can like us on Facebook. I want to thank my guests, J. Randy Taraborelli, his new book, Jackie, Janet, and Lee, The Secret Lies of Janet Auchincloss and her daughters, Jacqueline Kennedy Onassis and Lee Radswell. And I want to thank award-winning artist and educator Claire Rosen. Her book is called Imaginarium, The Process Behind the Pictures. From the Bookshelf is produced by Francis Venegas and Ollie Jackson. I'm Gary Shapiro, and we'll see you next time. Good night, everybody.